finished when she walked into an office where they were. She found out later that she had been right. Brad told Karen even more about his personal life. Although he hadn't told Lilia, he was quite open with Karen about his affair with his son's babysitter.
"Cheryl doesn't know," he said, grinning. "We did it at my house when the kids were napping and Cheryl was at work."
But he lied to Karen when he said his liaison with his 19-year-old babysitter was not a long-running affair.
"Cheryl was working and I wasn't. That was before I came to Citizens."
Karen soon saw, or rather heard, that the Cunninghams' marriage was not a happy one. Cheryl often called the Lake Oswego branch of Citizens, and Karen could tell from Brad's reaction that he was pretty upset. He would slam the phone down. There was a lot of anger. Indeed, there was more rage surfacing in Brad than Karen could ever remember seeing. In his business world, he was always in control, completely charming and affable. Whatever he and his wife were fighting over, Karen was shocked by the violence involved. Brad seemed to truly hate Cheryl, and although Karen couldn't hear the other end of the conversation, she appeared to hate him, too. Nevertheless, the phone scenes she overheard didn't diminish Brad's charisma for the young attorney. It was easier for her to feel a little sorry for him. His wife seemed to be a ranting shrew. Except in his phone conversations with Cheryl, Brad always struck Karen as such a nice guy. Karen sometimes went to a Portland tavern called Goose Hollow, and one evening she ran into Brad there. They played Scrabble, apparently a passion for him, and then he took her back to her apartment. In his version of their affair, he would recall that they had sex there for the first time. She would insist, however, that she was never actually intimate with Brad until after he left the bank they both worked for. And even then, she estimated that their affair had lasted only 3 or 4 months. Their friendship, however, continued. It was odd. Brad's wives all eventually came to hate his guts. His mistresses remained in his stable of friends. Estranged and former wives became prey and stalking targets. Mistresses were allowed to walk away. Brad never let up on his campaign to destroy Cheryl. Along with his other accusations in late 1985 and early 1986, he complained that he had contracted chlamydia from her. Technically, at least, chlamydia is a venereal disease, an infection usually transmitted through sexual intercourse. Righteously indignant, Brad obtained 2 prescriptions to treat himself. Why Brad insisted that Cheryl was the source of his infection is anyone's guess, given the fact that he was having sexual intercourse with a number of other women. But then Brad now blamed Cheryl for all bad things that happened to him. He no longer wanted her by 1985, but he wouldn't simply let her go. He accused her continually of being unfaithful, but he didn't tell her about his sexually transmitted infection, whatever its origin, and give her a chance to seek treatment. Indeed, it wasn't until February 3, 1986, when Cheryl began to suffer symptoms herself, that she went to see her own doctor. She learned that she had contracted vaginitis. A painful infection of the vaginal tissues, vaginitis has many causes. It can be transmitted through sexual contact, but it can occur just as often when a woman is treated for flu or a sore throat with antibiotics which tend to kill the protective bacteria always present in the vagina. A virgin can contract vaginitis. Both men and women can carry the infection and show no overt symptoms at all. Cheryl also tested positively for chlamydia. If she had, in fact, been the source of Brad's infection, she apparently went many weeks without symptoms after Brad had sought medical treatment. In those first months of 1986, Susan sensed that something in her sister's marriage was going to explode. Maybe Cheryl could hide her growing anxiety from her fellow attorneys, but she couldn't hide it from Susan, who noticed that she jumped every time the phone rang in her Seattle apartment. Susan couldn't hear Brad's side of their conversations, but she could tell he was always furious about something from the stricken look on Cheryl's pale face.
Although it had been more than 8 years since Susan had accompanied Brad and Cheryl on the frightening sailing trip to the San Juans, she again felt the same sense of dread. This wasn't the Cheryl she knew. The woman who could be instantly reduced to hysterical tears by a telephone call was not the real Cheryl, the Cheryl who never gave up, who never lost her confidence. Except with Brad. And now Brad had hostages. He had Jess, Michael, and Philip, and Cheryl had a new fear. She confided to Susan that she was afraid that one day she would go home and find not just her furniture missing, but her children, too. Susan had seen the way Brad disciplined his sons, despite Cheryl's desperate attempts to stop him. If they were out for dinner and one of the boys did something Brad considered inappropriate, like not eating all his food, or sulking, or crying, he would only say ominously that he'd take care of it. Cheryl would try to protect the kids, Susan said. She'd say he's tired, or he's hungry, or he just woke up from a nap. But Brad wouldn't listen to her. The boys knew that they would get swats when they got home. Very matter-of-factly, he'd tote up the swats. Jess would get two because he was the oldest. They knew they were going to get hit. Brad created an atmosphere of fear. They were obedient to the point that it was unnatural. They called him Dad, never Daddy. Those kids were his possessions. Brad gets whatever he wants. He wanted children and he wanted boys. Those boys were like another Mercedes to him. Cheryl's struggles became so difficult that Susan began keeping a diary. On February 1, 1986, she noted that Cheryl had had to be in Seattle overnight many times in a 3 or 4 week period during January. She got so lonely for Jess, Michael, and Philip that she asked her law firm for permission to bring her family up. They agreed, and somewhat uncharacteristically, so did Brad. He came up on the train with the boys. Susan offered to babysit on Saturday night, and Brad and Cheryl went out for dinner. Things seemed to be calm enough when Brad left for home on Sunday night, even though he was clearly annoyed that Cheryl had to stay in Seattle until the following Wednesday. But in reality, the situation had not been diffused at all. Brad started calling Cheryl almost from the moment he arrived in Gresham, as if he had been quietly fuming on the 4-hour train ride home. Susan remembered 7 or 8 calls. Cheryl was very upset. She was crying and yelling, trying to speak, and she couldn't. She cried so hard that she couldn't speak. It was so out of character for her. I begged her not to answer the phone when it rang, and he called all night, but she answered. Brad could destroy Cheryl even over the phone. As Susan listened, Cheryl began to scream and shout hysterically, "No, that's not true. No, I didn't do that. I didn't do that. You're lying to me." "Are you okay?" Susan whispered. "Everything's going to be all right," Cheryl replied, covering the phone with her hand. But Susan saw she didn't believe her own words. She wrote in her diary on February 3rd, 1986, "All hell broke loose last night and this morning. Brad and Cheryl fought, and I mean at the top of their lungs. It's very clear what she needs to do." What Cheryl had to do was get out of her marriage before she lost her equilibrium, her sanity, herself. One afternoon, Cheryl got a letter from Brad marked "Confidential." She read it without comment and set it down, but when she left the room, Susan's curiosity got the better of her. The letter said that, yes, Brad had had an affair with their former babysitter, but Marnie O'Connor didn't want him to tell anyone because her boyfriend and her mother might find out about it. Susan wasn't surprised. The guest room bed was always mussed up in that Gresham house, and Brad had a deadbolt lock put on that door. He was always saying, "Marnie likes to take naps during the day." He didn't even try to hide what was going on from Cheryl. Cheryl wasn't surprised by Brad's confidential letter, either. It didn't matter any longer. On Tuesday, February 5th, Cheryl seemed strangely calm and resolute. She didn't tell Susan about her visit to the doctor in Bellevue, where she had learned she was suffering from vaginal infections. She was humiliated. That diagnosis may have been the final straw. She told Susan only, "Everything's settled today. I'm going back to Portland." "I was relieved," Susan admitted. "My neighbors within a two-block radius could have heard their phone conversations. I was relieved she was gone." Later, of course, she would rue her feelings. Cheryl found an empty house when she arrived in Gresham. Brad had moved all the furniture out again, and at first Cheryl was exasperated with Rose, their current babysitter. But Susan reminded her when she called, "You know that Rose couldn't stop him. No one can stop Brad when he has his mind set on doing something." A few days after Cheryl left Susan's apartment, she called to say she had finally acknowledged there was no hope at all for her marriage. She wanted only to have Brad completely out of her life, although she didn't want her three boys to lose their father. There had to be some way for her and Brad to share custody. She could bear to see him that much, she supposed, just long enough for him to pick up the boys or deliver them back to her. In Seattle and Portland that February of 1986, there were breaks in the winter rains. The pussy willows budded out, and crocuses sprang from an earth no longer chained by winter. It was a season of hope and starting over, and it almost seemed as if Brad and Cheryl could separate without rancor. If they could somehow share Jess, Michael, and Philip, they had nothing left to fight over. "I was glad," Susan recalled, "that she was going to get a divorce. She just wasn't Cheryl anymore. For her own health and well-being, I was glad they were splitting up. Their marriage started out relatively normal on the surface, but somehow people were always uncomfortable around them as a couple." When Cheryl asked Brad to move out, he went, uncharacteristically without a fight. He found himself an expensive apartment on the 14th floor of the Madison Tower, then moved to an even more expensive one on the 18th floor. That didn't surprise Cheryl. Even though the place cost almost twice as much as the house their whole family had rented, she knew Brad. He always wanted the best for himself. She didn't care if he rented the Taj Mahal, as long as he was gone. Chapter 25. Cheryl had hoped that having Brad out of her home would bring some modicum of peace into her life, and it was true that when he finally moved out, he stopped playing musical chairs with the furniture. But Cheryl was still saddled with all his debts. Just before their separation, Brad had bought himself a huge, exotic, and expensive motorcycle, a Husqvarna. It was a racing bike, absolutely top of the line. Brad wasn't a motorcycle racer, and he kept the Husqvarna in the garage, unused. Cheryl begged him to sell it, along with other costly toys he had purchased and never used. She was desperately worried about money. Each week she felt she was deeper in debt. Cheryl called Susan on February 28th, and Susan could hear new panic in her voice. "Brad's not going to be reasonable about sharing custody after all," Cheryl said. "He told me he's going to fight me for the kids. He's been telling everyone I'm a nymphomaniac. He's trying to tear me apart. I need you to stand up for me." Susan assured Cheryl that she would be there for her and tried to tell her not to worry about Brad's threats and lies. Brad had always been that way. Nothing had really changed. But that was the problem. Even though they were now separated, he still had the power to send Cheryl into an emotional tailspin. It took every ounce of her strength to keep him at bay, and every time she felt a little thrill of hope, something happened to dash it. She and Brad made an uneasy truce in March and worked out a tentative agreement about their children. Brad would have their little boys from 7 p.m. on Friday until 7 p.m. on Sunday. The divorce itself lay ahead. Brad, who always fortified himself with lawyers, had already consulted his own attorney of the moment, Jake Tanzer, who would be only the first of three lawyers he hired and dismissed during his divorce proceedings. Tanzer was a highly respected Oregon attorney who had been at various times a deputy DA in Multnomah County, a court of appeals judge, the Solicitor General of Oregon, and an Oregon Supreme Court justice. He was in private practice in 1986, but he was not a divorce attorney. He told Brad that he could find himself an attorney who was fully versed in divorce litigation and at less than half the price. But Brad wanted Jake Tanzer. Brad's charm and convincing ways extended even to lawyers, and there would be many who were chagrined that they had ever met him. Few were ever paid. Cheryl knew that getting out of her marriage wasn't going to be easy, and she was fully aware that gaining custody of Jess, Michael, and Philip would be even harder. Every time there was a period of relative calm between her and Brad, she kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. For years she had had fear systematically implanted in her mind like tiny grains of radioactive material, so many little glowing seeds that being frightened was almost normal for her. Cheryl was afraid of the enemies that Brad talked about, of the assassins who were out to get him and his family since he brought his suits against the Houston firms he blamed for his financial downfall. But now, finally, she feared Brad himself more. She had never seen the invisible killers. She had seen Brad in a rage. Things began to happen, small but ominous things. In March, Cheryl was convinced that someone had tinkered with her Toyota van. She was almost afraid to drive it. The brakes seemed mushy, and it had suddenly begun to die in traffic for no reason at all. She got it to a garage where a mechanic said someone had messed up her carburetor so that the mixture of gas and air was way off. She asked Brad for all the Toyota keys, but he never gave them back to her. Brad had the tires for her van. He had stored them when he put snow tires on the van the previous fall. In Oregon, studded snow tires have to be replaced with regular tires by April 1st. That date was rapidly approaching, and she needed her almost new tires back. She didn't have the $400 it would take to replace them, and she didn't have the money to pay the fine she would get if she kept driving on snow tires after the cutoff date. She called Brad several times, asking that he bring back her tires. Brad returned her calls and spoke with her secretary or her legal assistant, and he was more than charming. But when Cheryl came on the line, his voice changed to a venomous pitch. He was much too busy to bother with her tires, and would she get off his back? Ironically for a lawyer, Cheryl had scarcely any money for legal help in her divorce. In the early spring, she retained the best, on the understanding that she would obtain her divorce on a shoestring budget. Cheryl herself would do as much of the legwork as she could. The woman she retained was one of the finest family law attorneys in Portland, Elizabeth Welch. Betsy Welch had graduated from the University of Chicago Law School and worked for the American Bar Association for some years after graduation. When she moved to Portland, she became a deputy district attorney in the Multnomah County Juvenile Court, specializing in child neglect and abuse and in the termination of parental rights. She worked for 5 years as the administrative assistant to Neil Goldschmidt, the mayor of Portland. Then she was appointed a circuit court judge. When she lost an election, she returned to private practice where she specialized, as always, in children, the rights of children, and the untangling of the traumatic situations in which husbands, wives, and children often found themselves. By 1991, she would once again be a judge, a district court judge in Multnomah County. Elizabeth Welch was the perfect lawyer for Cheryl. She was kind, she was smart, and she was a fighter. She also had a wonderful sense of humor, but that was not something she would be called upon to use. The early days after Brad moved out had been, as Cheryl feared, only deceptively calm. He was now gathering a head of steam and was preparing to roll over her, just as he had flattened every one of his other wives. From this point on, every issue, every procedure, every hearing, every order was marked by delay, fights, and tugs of war. The divorce should not have been that difficult. The only issue to be decided was child custody. There was no money to fight over. Brad had his ongoing bankruptcy action in Seattle, and Cheryl could barely keep her head above water financially. No, they were fighting over Jess, Michael, and Philip. And Brad knew full well this was the one area where he could terrorize Cheryl. This case was at the upper end of the acrimony scale, Betsy Welch would recall. Probably as high as any I have ever been involved in. Both of the people were very bright, very strong-minded. Nothing ever went through easily. Nothing. Every single issue was disputed. Nothing could be resolved amicably. Welch tried to count up the number of court appearances in the divorce and had difficulty doing so. Whatever the judge decided, the orders always had to be redone over and over. Brad fought Cheryl over daycare, school, support payments, everything she wanted and needed for the boys. It was ugly. During that awful spring of 1986, Brad waged a relentless paper war against Cheryl. He flooded her with letters, typed in perfect business form. Dear Cheryl, enclosed is a photocopy of my recent statement from Texaco. I have paid this bill in full. I would appreciate your reimbursing me $40.91 for your personal and business use. Together with the mobile card use, you owe me $107.85. Dear Cheryl, please accept this letter as my written request to have you return to me all my framed photographs from your office that were mine prior to our marriage. If you insist on keeping these, you may purchase them from me for $210. Please advise. Dear Cheryl, after the court order, I returned to you each and every item I had, the keys to our Toyota van, the house keys. I thought I had the garage door control. In fact, I thought it was last seen in Philip's diaper bag. I said I would replace the control if you couldn't find it. I will not pay to have the garage door control unit reprogrammed. Further, in the event you are planning to have the house door locks rekeyed, do not plan on me paying for that either. Dear Cheryl, I will attempt to work with you on getting the regular tires on the van. However, I would appreciate your returning my snow tires as soon as possible. Brad's letters to Cheryl were quite civil on the surface, but the veneer was thin. They piled into her home, sometimes several a day. There were scores of them. He signed them cordially, or thank you, or sincerely. Brad fought desperately to wrest whatever he could from Cheryl. He attempted to get the $1,000 damage deposit for the Gresham rental. He insisted that he had paid the deposit from my separate funds. Since Cheryl had been supporting the family for 2 years at that point, that claim was questionable. The landlords finally wrote to Brad's attorney and said they were writing a $1,000 check to both Brad and Cheryl. If one tries to cash it without the other, then a crime has been committed. Cheryl asked again for the return of the 4 standard tires with rims for Toyota van so I can replace the studded tires on the van by April 1st. Then one day her assistant said cheerfully, "Your husband called and said you didn't have to worry about your tires anymore. He said he took care of them." Cheryl was relieved until she went down to the parking area of Garvey Schubert and found all 4 of the studded tires on her van had been slashed. They had indeed been taken care of. Within a very few days after Cheryl hired Betsy Welch, and even before Welch could file the necessary documents for her divorce, Cheryl called her, very upset, and said that Brad had announced he would be moving back in with her, at his attorney's suggestion. As a general rule, that was good advice, and Welch knew it. There is no rule or law that says a spouse who has moved out of the home cannot move back in. In child custody cases, the parent who moves out acknowledges that the parent left behind with the children is providing acceptable care. In a disputed custody, this gives the parent who remains the upper hand. Brad had lost too many custody battles. Even Lonnie Ann, whom he had seen as the weakest link in his chain of women, had prevailed in court and had been awarded Kate and Brent. Lauren had controlled his visits with Amy. He had let his first three children go, finally, because he had Jess, Michael, and Philip, three bright, handsome sons who looked so much like himself. He was not about to let Cheryl have them. They were his trophies, his prizes. They reflected his boundless ego, miniature versions of himself who would validate his manhood, his potency, and his power. Betsy Welch immediately called Brad's current lawyer and explained why she felt it would be a fruitless and emotionally damaging move for Brad to return to Cheryl's Gresham house. But Brad did exactly what he had threatened to do. When Cheryl got home from work on the Friday evening of a long holiday weekend, she found him in her bedroom. She was horrified and she was angry, but she was helpless to get him out. Betsy Welch couldn't go into court until Tuesday morning to ask for an order to remove Brad. Cheryl knew he wasn't there for anything more than to reestablish his legal beachhead. "It was a very long, confrontive, unpleasant weekend," Welch recalled. Cheryl asked him to go, but Brad refused to budge. At one point he took Jess with him and locked them both in the master bedroom for hours. He wouldn't allow Cheryl in to get her clothes, her makeup, or anything else she needed. The boys were frantic. Cheryl was frantic. But Brad stayed put as if he had never left his home at all. Although the house had six bedrooms, Cheryl slept on the couch in the recreation room so that she could watch the stairs from the master bedroom. She was afraid Brad might leave with the boys. It was a ghastly 3 days, and Cheryl wondered hopelessly if Brad actually intended to take up their sham of a marriage. He acted as if he was home again for good, and the thought was almost more than she could bear. Knowing that he would listen in to all her phone calls on the bedroom extension, she nevertheless called her mother. Trapped in the house with Brad, she had to have someone to talk to. As they discussed the situation, Betty made a bad joke about ways to get rid of Brad.
"Maybe we should just poison him," she said. "I think I read someplace that a woman did that to an abusive husband, and they let her go."
Neither mother nor daughter realized what a devastating impact their conversation would have on Brad. He looked at everything from his own point of view. The point of view of a man who had virtually no sense of humor, who believed that the end, his end, justified the means, any means, and who considered women spawn of the devil. Chapter 26. Even though Brad had told her that he had to spend the weekend with his sons, Dr. Sarah Gordon was blissfully happy, delighted with the new man in her life. She had no idea of the hell Cheryl Keaton was living in. Brad seemed to Sarah to be very kind, very honest, and quite remarkable. Often she marveled at her good fortune in finding such a man. Within weeks of their meeting, she was as anxious as he to have his divorce finalized. She was just as concerned as he was about his poor children, who had to spend so much time with the woman Brad had described to her as a slut and an incompetent mother. She knew that Brad was only doing what he had to do to save his sons. Of course, Brad had never intended to leave Sarah or the comforts of his new apartment permanently. Once he had proven that he could move back in any time he pleased, he left Cheryl's house and returned to the Madison Tower. Both of them aware of the inflammatory possibilities in the divorce action they were handling, Jake Tanzer and Betsy Welch worked together to find the best solution not only for Cheryl and Brad, but especially for Jess, Michael, and Philip.
Apparently, each of the parents loved the boys, and the opposing attorneys hoped that a psychologist could help establish which of the dueling parents, if either, and if not, both, should have custody of their sons. They needed to know who was the primary parent. Where would the little boys fare better? With their mother? With their father? Tanzer suggested to Betsy Welch that they contact an expert who was not under the aegis of the family court to be sure they had the most unbiased evaluation possible. Dr. Russell Sardo, quite probably the leading clinical psychologist in the family counseling field in the Portland area in the mid-80s, agreed to consult. He would attempt to establish whether Brad or Cheryl was the primary parent. Dr. Sardo would talk to each of them separately, administer the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, to both, and then visit with Jess, Michael, and Philip, and hope to get a fix on the family dynamics. After extensive testing and multiple interviews, Sardo would then deliver copies of his report to Jake Tanzer and Betsy Welch. Dr. Sardo spoke first with Brad on March 23, 1986, and found him very verbal and quite comfortable in communicating. His body posture was relaxed, as if he were a man whose career had been full of high-powered meetings, as indeed it had been. Brad explained to Dr. Sardo that he and Cheryl had been married for 6 years and separated for 1 month. "I am the children's primary parent. I always have been," Brad said with assurance. "My wife loves the children very much, but I don't think she likes them. She is not a natural parent. The children were my idea." Brad stressed that he had been the one who longed to have children in their home, while Cheryl had always seen her legal career as her main goal in life. Although he assumed that Cheryl's profession would equip her to be a superior litigator and make her a trained negotiator, Dr. Sardo wondered if he might not be speaking to the skilled negotiator of this family. Brad was very glib and dynamic, and his description of Cheryl's parenting abilities was devastating. He told Sardo that she was not a nurturer. She had no patience. She was overreactive and loses control, and she was critical and condemning when dealing with her small sons. He said that Cheryl often yelled at the boys, calling them fuckers and little assholes. Cheryl's career took precedence over everything else in her life, according to Brad. She was always gone, and it was his perception that Cheryl found it very difficult even to be around the children, unless, of course, she had someone to help her care for them. Brad sighed as he told Sardo that Cheryl just didn't have the inclination or the skills to cope with the complete care of Jess, Michael, and Philip. "Perhaps hedonistic would describe Cheryl," Brad said. And he went on to describe her as a very sexual person who had been promiscuous. Dr. Sardo listened quietly now as the man sitting in his office tried to wipe out his wife with words. The Cheryl Keaton that Brad sketched sounded indeed like a selfish, dissolute woman who wouldn't be a good mother for any child. But Sardo had listened to 1,000 couples argue over their children, and he had long ago learned to reserve judgment until he had heard both principles out. Smiling expansively, Brad went on to say that he, on the other hand, had been absolutely faithful in his marriage. As remote as such a possibility might be, he said he actually hoped for a reconciliation. He wanted nothing more than to be back with Cheryl and his children in a solid family unit. It had always been Cheryl who wanted the divorce. He felt further that she was seeking custody of their 3 boys not because she wanted them, but because she is combative. Sardo was a little bemused by Brad. He was, at the very least, a very complicated man. Sardo found him quite intelligent and sophisticated, and yet he caught inconsistencies in Brad's statements, jarring discrepancies that a man of his obvious brilliance should have noted and censored before they ever passed his lips. Although Brad had stressed early in the interview how scrupulously faithful he had been throughout his marriage, he suddenly reversed himself and described a period when he and Cheryl had had an open marriage. During this time, Brad admitted he had had an affair with their 19-year-old babysitter. It hadn't lasted too long, and he had told Cheryl about it.
And how did she react?
We still kept her as our babysitter for months after that, Brad replied. Sardo's expression betrayed none of his private thoughts, gave no hint of the weighing and evaluating of information that was going on in his mind. Brad plunged ahead, figuratively tearing Cheryl apart so that she seemed to be a woman with no virtues whatsoever, beyond intelligence and a vigorous work ethic. Early on, Brad had described himself as the primary parent, but now he recalled that he had begun that role only after his business reverses. My bankruptcy changed me, almost destroyed me. I concluded that a career and money are just not that important, and that my primary commitment to the children takes precedence. I will not work more than 40 hours a week now. So, Sardo realized, Brad had not been the primary parent until the last year or so, if at all. His subject continued to talk volubly. A few moments later, Brad reversed himself again and said he had a job offer from U.S. Bank that he intended to accept, although he would also keep his current job. Sardo noted that Brad seemed unaware that a second job would mean he would be working far more than 40 hours a week, and that there would be little, if any, time left for his sons. How, then, could Brad be the primary parent? Sardo didn't ask the question aloud, and Brad still hadn't recognized the rampant inconsistencies in his statements. Brad had, of course, fathered a number of children, and he listed his offspring from his three previous marriages. Brent, who was 15, was currently living with him. With intense feeling in his voice, Brad recalled his deep concern about Brent and Kate when they were young. He said he had begged their mother to change her hippie lifestyle for the children's sake. He had been upset at the idea of his two little children being raised in the laissez-faire ambiance of a commune. Brad admitted he had married his second wife only because he needed to be married so he could fight for custody of Brent and Kate. He always had done, and always would do, whatever he had to make sure his children were in the safest environment possible. When the judge in his first custody hearing ruled against him, he had quickly ended his marriage of convenience. Sardo mentally counted on his fingers. Neither of Brad's first two marriages had come about because he loved his brides. Lonnie Ann Erickson had been pregnant, and Cynthia Marasco had been used as a means to an end not achieved. There were also some glaring gaps in Brad's review of his life as a parent. Although he claimed to have loved his third wife, Lauren, he didn't explain to Sardo why he had left her when she was pregnant with his child, except to hint that Cheryl had seduced him. He said that he had, naturally, taken care of that little girl, Amy, who was born after he left Lauren for Cheryl. When Brad walked out of Dr. Sardo's office, he was as confident as when he walked in, and quite secure in his belief that he had made a good impression. He had been calm, and yet he had shown his profound feelings for his sons appropriately. Cheryl would be nervous. She would not come off well. She was too intense, too scattered, and far too frantic in her fear that he was going to take Jess, Michael, and Philip away from her. On March 24th, Cheryl presented herself to be tested, and it was immediately obvious that she was nothing like the foul-mouthed shrew, the sex-driven huntress that Brad had described. If she was that woman, she certainly hid it well. Dr. Sardo found Cheryl's demeanor much different from her husband's. She was very intelligent and verbal, just as he had found Brad to be. No surprises there. However, Cheryl was far more responsive to his questions. Unlike Brad, she didn't immediately launch into her side of the case, but rather let Sardo phrase questions for her to answer. Cheryl said that she felt that their temporary custody truce was working fairly well. But she agreed with Brad that all negotiations in the past to seek a permanent order had been utterly fruitless. These two areas were the only ones where Cheryl's perceptions matched Brad's, and although Brad had smiled and told Sardo that he and Cheryl could work out custody without any outside counseling, Cheryl shook her head in alarm. They could not. They had tried, and it wasn't working. It wasn't working at all. It never could. She was insistent that they had to have someone mediate. Brad, Cheryl said, had become extremely difficult to deal with. Even the most minor issues would spark yet another huge fight between them. In a sense, she had been surprised by Brad's stubborn and violent response to her custody requests. "In the past, when we discussed divorce," she said, "Brad sometimes said he wouldn't even see the boys, and I couldn't deal with that." As unhappy as she had become in her marriage, she could not rob her sons of their father. But currently, that was not a concern. Brad was resisting every one of her suggestions about the boys, wanting to be part of the most minuscule decisions about their lives, so much so that they seemed unable to reach any resolution of their children's future. Cheryl told Sardo that she had no problem any longer in accepting that her marriage was over. She was at peace with her decision to divorce. Her marriage was completely dead. There was nothing in the world that could revive the love she had believed she and Brad felt for each other, and she was anxious to get on with her life. As for the primary parent question, Cheryl recalled for Sardo all the times Brad had left her and the boys. She had always been the parent who stayed with the children. She told him that it was she who had been alone with her sons most of the time since October 1982, when she returned to Seattle from Houston to resume her law practice to help fund Brad's business in Texas. Until they had moved to Portland in early 1985, Brad had lived away from them, except for short visits. When Sardo asked her to describe Brad, Cheryl said that he was very demanding, very harsh, and used physical discipline, including beatings with a belt on the boys. Pondering his parenting stance, she finally characterized it as militaristic. The father Cheryl described was like a Marine DI, expecting his sons to obey instantly and without question. In his testimony, Sardo didn't mention the child's coffin in their garage or the dead animal trophies Brad had the boys bring back from their trips to Yakima. Perhaps Cheryl worried about what Dr. Sardo might think of her for having allowed such things to go on. Cheryl told Sardo that she was the caregiver, she was the nurturer, although she had always tried not to say anything negative about Brad to the boys. He was their father, and she wanted them to know him and respect him, even when he was always gone. Little boys needed to believe in their father. But even when Brad was unemployed, Cheryl said, he had never stayed home to care for the boys. He was always leaving on trips, to Yakima, to Houston, to California, to wherever, always working on some mysterious projects. She had had to hire babysitters. Brad was simply not a man who would submit to being tied down with regular child care. In the weeks to come, in sessions with Cheryl and Brad together, Dr. Sardo would observe the interaction between them. When Cheryl was in the same room with Brad, she seemed to shrink and become very quiet. Sardo was surprised. Although Cheryl was the attorney, it was obviously Brad who had a very intrusive style in transacting. Sardo noted that Brad applied pressure in a great many different areas at different times, controlling the conversation as floodgates control the ebb and flow of a river. If he hadn't known better, he would have thought that Brad, not Cheryl, was the experienced trial attorney. Sardo also saw that Cheryl was actually a little intimidated by her husband. She made no attempt at all to negotiate with Brad alone. He ran the show. Very occasionally, Cheryl stood up to him on issues that were vitally important to her. There were certain lines that she had drawn in her mind, and she would not let Brad cross over. Even so, Cheryl was always the one on the defensive. It was she who sat braced for Brad's next verbal assault. In the Minnesota multiphasic personality inventory tests that Sardo administered, tests consisting of more than 500 carefully worded questions to be answered yes or no, Brad's and Cheryl's personalities emerged clearly, like mountain peaks thrusting through clouds. The MMPI test has many deliberate lie questions which appear several times. Anyone who tries to fool the test tends to answer the way he believes the test designers want him to, and that desire to please is transparently clear to those who chart test results. Dr. Sardo's evaluation of Brad's MMPI test results was that he presented himself as an individual who was very much in control, very selective about the information he was providing, and very concerned with trying to provide an appropriate picture. The picture he tried to put forth was one of sensitivity and tenderness. But Sardo also detected other traits in Brad's MMPI scores. The test revealed that he was a very guarded individual who doesn't allow intimacy with others and who has little genuine insight. Sardo noted that Brad had a strong tendency to project onto someone else undesirable traits he himself might have. Either he had virtually no awareness of his own personality, or he contrived to slough off negative traits and attribute them to others. Moreover, Brad Cunningham, whose facade was that of an extremely strong, even macho, male, scored much higher than normal in feminine traits. Brad thought that he had aced the MMPI, that he had snowed Sardo completely, and succeeded in convincing him that Cheryl was a temperamental bitch who cared more for her career and her sex life than she did for her sons. Sardo had seen an entirely different woman. Cheryl's MMPI test scores supported the statements she had given in her earlier interviews with Dr. Sardo. Although she jousted very successfully with males in a profession where females were still in the minority, the test revealed that Cheryl identified with a very traditional female role. She was far less guarded and defensive than Brad in her answers. She showed herself to be a person with a great deal of energy and also as someone who could be impulsive. And most interesting to Dr. Sardo, given the reason for the MMPI tests, Cheryl's answers disclosed who she was at her very center. Despite her very high profile and assertive career, she was at heart a mother, a wife, a nurturer. Weighing what he knew about Brad and Cheryl, Dr. Sardo next visited with their sons. Jess was 6, Michael 4, and Philip 2. And it was clear that someone had taken very good care of them. Remarkably untouched by the custody squabbles that swarmed around them like angry bees, they were active and playful little boys. When Dr. Sardo asked them who they lived with, Jess said, "Mom." Michael said, "Mom and Dad." When he asked them which parent was more fun, Michael instantly said, "Mom." Jess said, "Mostly Mom," and then quickly said, "Mostly Dad." Sardo found the Cunningham children spontaneous, alert, curious, and extremely intelligent. The two older boys said they could play chess and did so with both of their parents. In fact, the boys seemed so well adjusted that Sardo could only conclude that both Brad and Cheryl must be concerned with their children's well-being, just as each of them claimed. Despite the struggle he had observed between Brad and Cheryl, he couldn't find that either parent's behavior had been detrimental to the boys.
They certainly seemed to be unstressed and happy little kids. In the couple's joint sessions with Dr. Sardo, Cheryl kept hoping that she and Brad could reach a reasonable custody agreement, but Brad would not give an inch. Time after time, Sardo watched Brad flare up and stride toward the door, saying flatly, "I'll see you in court." Why did Brad have to make this process so much worse than it needed to be, he wondered. Dr. Sardo's decision wasn't easy. It never was, but this couple was more difficult to evaluate than most. In good conscience, he couldn't say one parent was a monster and the other a saint. He couldn't even say that one parent would be harmful to the children. It was just that the odds were that Cheryl had been the more consistent parent, and he recommended that the children would probably be better off with their mother. As to reaching a rational and equitable division of the parents' time with Jess, Michael, and Philip, Sardo realized that was never going to happen. In the end, although both Cheryl and Brad had said they were seeking a way to achieve joint custody of the boys, Sardo was unable to effect any happy resolution at all. He had to decide, then, which parent would be deemed the parent. Dr. Sardo determined that Cheryl had always been the major caregiver. She had been more reliable and showed fewer inconsistencies in her statements, and she had been all alone with her children for long periods while Brad had pursued his business interests. Much of that time, Brad had been more than 1,000 miles away, and it was hard to picture him as the key parent. Moreover, Sardo suspected that Brad's sense of competition over the boys was a major factor in this bitter and ongoing dispute. He was quite clearly a man who wanted to win any battle he was engaged in. He did not win this battle. Cheryl was deemed the primary parent of Jess, Michael, and Philip Cunningham. The question now was whether Brad would let go. He wanted his three boys. He wanted to shut their mother completely out of their lives if he could, and he was still determined to accomplish that. Chapter 27. Cheryl had married Brad, as Johnny Cash and June Carter sang in their country song, in a fever. She had stayed with him years longer than most would have, almost blindly determined to make their marriage last. At first, his life before he came into hers hadn't mattered, and later, she was quite probably afraid to go poking around into Brad's business, too wary to search for the secrets she was sure existed. But now, as she met Brad on the battlefield of divorce, she set about turning over the rocks of her estranged husband's past. Until the summer of 1986, Cheryl had known only one of Brad's previous three wives, her one-time sorority sister and former friend, Lauren Swanson. After what she and Brad had done to Lauren, Cheryl could hardly expect to go to her now and ask for help. Brad had made Lauren sound like the next thing to an axe murderess. Belatedly, Cheryl understood that she had been duped into believing what Brad wanted her to believe. He had lied about Lauren, just as he was lying about her now. No, Lauren had just been another of Brad's wife victims, and Cheryl wondered how many more there might be. How many women had Brad victimized in the past? More important, how many would talk about it? Cheryl had never really had a reason or an excuse to contact Lonnie Ann Cunningham before. Both Kate and Brent had visited in Cheryl's various homes, but Brad had allowed Cheryl precious little say about their care. They were not her children, they were his. Cheryl hadn't known about Kate's terror during her months with her father in Houston. Had she known, she would have tried to rescue the little girl, but Kate's ordeal in Houston was only one more of Brad's secrets. During this bitter summer of 1986, Cheryl knew that Brent was in Portland and living with Brad in the Madison Tower. Cheryl feared for him. He was a nice young man, not even 16 yet. He didn't have Brad's aggressive, super-confident personality. Nothing like it. He could be so easily crushed by the sheer force of his father. Lonnie Ann Cunningham wasn't easy to locate. Cheryl discovered that Brad's first wife had done her best to hide from him for more than 2 decades. Her address was not listed in public records. It took weeks for Cheryl to find Lonnie Ann in Brooklyn, New York, where she was working as a kinesiology therapist. Cheryl called to warn her that Brad's apartment was not the best place for Brent to be living. Although Lonnie Ann was worried, there was little she could do. Brent had gone to school in Brooklyn until his freshman year in high school. With his red hair and blue eyes, he had stuck out like a sore thumb, the only fair-haired student in a school where every other student had brown eyes and black hair. "They walk around me as if I spoke a foreign language," he told his mother, and he begged to go back to the Northwest to live. Lonnie Ann had hoped that Brent was faring well with his father. He was a son, and Brad had always treated his sons better than his daughters. Although Lonnie Ann was still afraid, she did give Cheryl some details about her own life with Brad. She recounted the bitter custody hearings for Brent and Kate. Cheryl was even able to get a half-promise from Lonnie Ann that she might give a deposition to help in her own custody struggle. Slowly, very slowly, after all her years with Brad, Cheryl began to uncover the real truth about the man she had married and to learn the almost unbelievable story of the years before he came into her life. Brad had never allowed her to know his mother or his sisters. True, he had taken Cheryl to some of the Cunningham family reunions, but his mother, Rosemary, had never been there. She had long since been banished. Brad had never wanted to talk about his mother and instantly quashed any mention of her, and he preferred that Cheryl maintain a very low profile at the family celebrations and not mention her career. So she had said scarcely anything, just engaged in woman talk about babies and recipes. The men had seemed to dictate the way the reunions would go. The women brought the food and stayed in their place. Cheryl knew almost nothing about Brad's sisters, Ethel and Susan. He had said they weren't worth knowing. He had cared about his father, and he had suffered the presence of his father's wife, Mary, because Sanford wanted her with him. The rest of his family hadn't really existed for Brad. It was the same with his Indian roots. Brad didn't want to talk about them, and he never wanted Cheryl to ask questions about his relatives. In her legal cases, Cheryl had always been so meticulous in her research that she was prepared for any eventuality. In her personal life, she had chosen to believe what Brad told her about his childhood, his family, his mother, his sisters, his ex-wives. At first, she hadn't questioned him because she loved him. Later, she was cautious about making waves. But now she jotted down notes and the names of people who might testify in her divorce case. If it got nasty, and she was quite sure it would, she would have a list of potentially devastating witnesses who could recall the days when Brad Cunningham was part of their lives. Cheryl was determined to work her way back through Brad's past. She was going to find Rosemary and Ethel and Susan. She would try to get Lonnie Ann and Cynthia and Lauren to testify for her. She didn't yet know the details of all of Brad's previous marriages, divorces, and child custody cases, but she had reason to suspect they had been much like hers, and she was going to validate her suspicions. She was a woman on fire, prepared to ignore her own terror and throw herself into what seemed, at least to her, a life-and-death struggle. Cheryl was adamant that she would handle the witness list for her divorce trial, so adamant, in fact, that Betsy Welch was a bit put off. After all, Cheryl had hired her, yet sometimes it seemed she wanted to run her own case, and any attorney knows that he who represents himself has a fool for a client. But Cheryl was so caught up in this divorce and custody action that she had forgotten. "Don't worry about the witnesses," she told Welch. "I'll have the witnesses."
Cheryl's decision to open up Brad's past to scrutiny may have been a fatal move, but she didn't care. She was a tigress, obsessed with protecting her young. She was no longer cowed. She was no longer afraid. She feared no humiliation. She had become the worst enemy that Brad Cunningham had ever known, and the most dangerous. Chapter 28. Brad was angry when Dr. Russell Sardo declared that Cheryl was the primary parent of their children. More than most men, he considered himself an exceptional father, and he was sincerely dumbfounded when Dr. Sardo didn't understand. He had pulled out all the stops when he talked with Sardo, certain he had won him over. Now he doubted Sardo's competence as a psychologist. Under ordinary circumstances, Brad might have raged more at Cheryl over Sardo's decision than he did, but it was during the week following his sessions with Sardo that he met Sarah Gordon, and she seemed to be everything that Cheryl no longer was to Brad. She was as beautiful as Cheryl, but she was daintier, more delicate, and seemingly more pliant. True, their first date had been a little stilted, but then Brad turned on the charm and Sarah responded. And he had quickly determined she had a handsome income, several times as much as Cheryl's. Brad plunged into an intense relationship with Sarah almost immediately and was soon courting her with his experienced and well-honed romantic fervor. As far as Sarah knew, and all her information came from Brad's lips, Cheryl was a monstrous mother, a faithless wife, and a morally loose woman. Brad would make sure that his about-to-be ex-wife and his new love didn't meet face-to-face. His relationship with Sarah had nothing whatsoever to do with his determination to gain custody of his sons. Sarah was the next step up for him. Cheryl was old but very pressing business. Even so, when his efforts to get custody of Jess, Michael, and Philip were met by Cheryl's inflexible stance and her temporary victory, it didn't send Brad into one of his customary rages. He was still angry at Cheryl, but he had Sarah to talk to now. She was on his side. Quite probably, their love affair made the summer of 1986 far more serene for everyone concerned than it otherwise would have been. Cheryl was still uneasy. When you have been living in a war zone and the shelling suddenly stops, the ensuing silence is eerie. She didn't trust the quiet, didn't believe for a moment that Brad had given up. He had moved back in with her once. She had no guarantee that he wouldn't move in again. In June, to forestall such an eventuality, Cheryl invited her half-brother Jim Carr to share her home with her and the boys. She could no longer afford the Gresham house, and she looked for a rental more within her means. Her law career was just as remunerative as it had always been, even more so, but she would have to put away funds to pay for the legal fight she knew lay ahead. And so she made arrangements to rent a house on 81st Street in the West Slope area west of Portland, just beyond the zoo. The public schools there were good. It would be another fresh start. And this time, she prayed, it would be a lasting one. There was no way she could keep her new address secret from Brad. He had to know where his sons were living. But she could move to a place where bleak and frightening memories didn't mark every room. Cheryl wouldn't be any farther away from Brad. Actually, his apartment at the Madison Tower was equidistant from Gresham and the West Slope. Nothing would change the fact that Brad still had dominion over Jess, Michael, and Philip for nearly half of each week. Having her half-brother live with her would make Cheryl feel safer. It wasn't that Jim was a muscular hunk. Actually, he was a slender young man whom Brad could easily have broken in two. But he would be another adult there in the house with her. That meant a lot to Cheryl, having somebody to talk to, someone who loved her, and a link to a time in her past when life was much simpler and much safer. but even the seemingly innocuous move of inviting Jim to move in with her set off another skirmish. Brad doubted that Carr was capable of caring for his three sons. He demanded that he have psychological testing to determine if he was suited for child care. Cheryl had warned Jim that Brad was prone to off-the-wall demands, so he shrugged and agreed to be tested. Jim met with Dr. Sardo for 45 minutes in July of 1986, and Sardo reported that he would do just fine with Jess, Michael, and Philip. Grudgingly, Brad agreed to the arrangement. Jim Carr was a journeyman carpenter, and he had enough free time to help his half-sister out. He and Cheryl would be able to mesh their schedules so that one or the other of them was always with the boys. The arrangement was symbiotic. Cheryl would give Jim $50 a week, room and board, and gasoline and other necessities. That summer, Cheryl and Brad continued to alternate time with the boys, pending the outcome of their divorce. July and August were almost spookily tranquil. When Brad asked to take his sons on vacation, Cheryl acquiesced without arguing. Even though the fear that he would simply disappear and take her children with him walked with her always, Cheryl knew about Brad's relationship with Sarah Gordon. She was reassured when Brad told her Sarah was going along on their vacation. Sarah had a practice to come back to and a solid reputation. Cheryl didn't know Sarah, but the boys liked her. It hardly seemed probable that she would help Brad hide the children from their mother. Her intuition was right. Brad brought the boys back on time, and Cheryl could breathe again. Meanwhile, she continued her investigation of Brad as if she were preparing for the biggest trial of her life, as indeed she was. She kept meticulous notes of every encounter she had with him. Brad was unaware that all of his phone conversations with Cheryl were written down and marked with date and time. Cheryl confided in Eric Lindenauer. She had been his mentor when he was a fledgling lawyer at Garvey Schubert, and now Eric attempted to be her protector and her confidant. Cheryl needed someone to talk to, someone with whom she could explore her doubts, her suspicions, and her fears. Eric was more than a decade younger than she was, and they had never had anything other than the most platonic of relationships, but he loved her as a brother would love her. Although Cheryl hadn't been actively involved in Brad's business dealings during their marriage, common law made her a partner. Sometimes her signature had been required on documents. More often, she didn't have to sign to be equally responsible. She was Brad's wife. She had become aware of irregularities that troubled her. She told Eric that Brad hadn't filed returns on his business income for the past 3 years. Before that, she said he had put false information on the returns he had filed. Cheryl had seen vast amounts of money pass through his hands. She had never been sure where it came from or where it went. She knew that Brad had owned heavy equipment worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, equipment that should have been listed when he filed for bankruptcy. All assets remaining in a bankrupt estate are legally supposed to be marshaled to pay creditors and a trustee appointed to see that that happened. "Brad's got construction equipment that's never been accounted for," Cheryl told Eric. "I'm sure he's hidden it over near Yakima someplace. He's driving brand new vehicles. Nobody who's bankrupt could have so much." Brad was still living at the Madison Tower like a man who had money to burn. Before his job with Citizens ended in mid-April, a professional headhunter had placed him in his top position with U.S. Bank. The bank had purchased his personal vehicle, a Volkswagen Cabriolet, and given it back to him to use. His new job paid close to $100,000 a year and came with perks too numerous to list. He was basically in charge of all the commercial property loans in the Spectrum division of U.S. Bank. He hadn't exaggerated to Sarah when he told her